Hi, this is Dave Douglas. You're listening to the A Noise from the Deep podcast from Greenleaf Music. I'm here with Michael Bates.
Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm proud to say that this is the geeky special trumpet freakout edition. We're going to be talking with John McNeil, the great trumpet player and composer and man about town.
Knows everybody, for sure.
And John also knows and has known a lot of the great trumpet players. So we'll start out listening to some of John's music. This is Finally Done, his composition from his new record, Hush Point. And then we'll get into some conversation. So hope you enjoy it. So welcome, John McNeil. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks for asking, Dave.
Oh, man. I mean, you've been such an inspiration to me. And, well, you were actually my teacher. And I still think of you as my teacher, and I send everyone I can your way.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I remember about you, I remember you were very self-directed. And I'd say, well, Dave, you need to work on this, so... Yeah, and he said, okay, fine. And sometimes you'd come back the next week, and you'd have it all. You know, yeah, I did this, but I also square-rooted it, and I did this, and I did it backwards, and I transposed it to some other thing, you know, and that's pretty good. But sometimes, I remember twice, you came back. I don't know why I remember twice, but you were kind of a memorable kid, and you said, you know, I didn't actually do what you said. I got sidetracked and I was transcribing this. This one time it was a Charlie Parker solo, I remember. You told me I got sidetracked getting into this Charlie Parker solo and I transcribed it. And hey man, look what he does on this, you know. And so we basically checked out the solo you'd written out and didn't write all of it out, but you could play all of it. And I said, like, wow, this is pretty good. This guy's going to be great someday. I remember that your trumpet playing was you know, kind of suspect, and I was wondering, well, I wonder if he's going to get that together. I think we might have even talked about it for one time or another. And lo and behold, you turned into this fabulous trumpet player. Like a few years later. I don't think you went. Nice. How old are you? Like 18 or something like that?
I think I was 18 or 19, but you know, you turned me on to Carmine Caruso, and you remember that's kind of what turned it around for me.
Oh yeah, well that's the story with everybody.
And
you know,
it happened relatively quickly. Once
it sure did, and you know who else it happened quickly for was actually Freddie Hubbard.
Oh.
Because I remember Carmine. I knew that Freddie had studied with him, and so I asked Carmine about it. He said, yeah, I've never seen anybody improve that quickly. It only took him about 6 months, and he just had it all together. He said he was a good trumpet player, but he moved a lot of extraneous motion, and a couple other things wrong. And so he said, I just set to working on it, and he worked at it like a fiend, you know, like he did. And
what year,
can really hear it on records.
What year would that have been, do you think?
That was just prior to the quota, I believe. That one, that album he did for what's his name, Jimmy Heath. right then you can hear him starting to really take hold, you know. About that one time, he said, "Man, that was the answer. That's all I needed.
That was all I needed.
Right. Yeah.
So, as a non trumpet player, can I jump in and ask what was it about Carmine Caruso that led to, you know, you guys turning your trumpet playing around and Freddie Hubbard?
You could add me into there too. I started studying with him right after I got to New York, and all of a sudden, I was not overmatched anymore.
What was it about his method?
Well, what he did was work on, oddly enough, it was basically about timing.
Mm-hmm.
He said that the coordination is the movement of muscles in time. So if you work on the timing, you improve the coordination. And trumpet playing is about coordination, as opposed to what people always think it is.
So we're talking about like the mechanics of trumpet playing, like putting a valve down and air mechanics. And
yeah, not so much the valve. It's sort of like coordinating all the different parts,
right?
And doing exercise to make sure you don't keep changing the shape of your embouchure and the placement of the mouthpiece every time you take it off. You know, and every register you move into, make sure you don't change the position of the mouthpiece and everything. Keep basically, that's called an embouchure, and you better keep the same embouchure throughout the range of your horn. And when I went to him, he said I had like maybe four different embouchures that I used: a low one, a middle one, a high one, and a one for playing loud. You know, and it was. And
that's
by the time it was over, like right now, I basically have one.
That's really funny, because by the time I got to him, which was a few years later, he just said, "Shut up and do the exercises." Like there was no analysis of you know. He was. I would ask him, you know, what am I doing? He'd say, "You don't even think about it."
Yeah, right.
Just do the exercises.
To get him to talk about it, what you had to do, you had to go over to the China Song and have like a few drinks with him.
That's what I was just going to say.
The China Song was, at that time, this is pre-cell phone, it was a Chinese restaurant in Midtown, not too far from his studio. They had a giant bank of payphones back by the coat room. I mean, I don't know how many payphones, it must have been maybe 30 of them. And as a result, it was a hangout for all of the studio musicians and all the guys who were just constantly checking their calls, checking their service and stuff like that.
Right.
And
Broadway Danny and, Rose.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was just, you could go into the China Song, you stay there, come in around noon and just stay until closing. I bet you'd see probably 60-70% of the studio musicians in town walk through there. Easily, and sometimes twice, because it was a place to hang and see everybody. And of course, Carmine just was there all the time. He called it his Far East office. it's pretty great.
Yeah. Well, did Thad ever interact? Thad Jones, did he ever interact with Carmine?
I think maybe he might have known him, but I don't think he ever spoke about him too much or. He asked me, he said, "Man, your trumpet playing sounded better. You know, sounded stronger." I said, "Well, I'm studying with Carmine." And he said, "Oh, good." Huh. So he knew about it, you know. But Thad was sure a great trumpet player.
Mm.
Nobody ever gives him enough credit for that either. I mean, he started playing a cornet. You know, you look at old videos of him playing with Count Basie. He comes out front and plays a solo. He's playing on trumpet. And you can hear what a grand trumpet player this guy is. It's fantastic. He started playing cornet, and he told me that he actually played some lead on the Basie band, playing that cornet, which is really interesting. Wow. I never knew he played any lead. He said, "Yeah, I did a few tunes I played lead on," and I played his cornet. And it was one. It was an old one. It was, I don't know what year, but way back, like in 1927 or something like that, he got it. Con, I can't remember. It might have been a con. And but the thing I remember about it is that it played like a trumpet. I've never, ever, to this day, not before or since, have I ever played a cornet that played that open.
Hmm.
It played it just like a trumpet. I could actually play the damn thing.
Hmm.
And you know, when I you switch from cornet to, for trumpet to cornet, it's like a different blow, kind of, you know, and you have to, because it's more of a conical instrument. You can't really force air through it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do any of that stuff. But this one here, you could not overblow it. I mean, it was incredible.
Hmm.
And so he actually played some lead with that on the Basie band. I remember one time walking down 7th Avenue, I was going to go hear the band on Monday night, and I was walking down 7th Avenue, and I saw about a block away, and I heard this trumpet playing. I said, "God, this guy sounds good, you know, I wonder who that is." And I got closer to the club, I realized it was somebody inside, you know, so what's going on? So I opened the door, and I could hear it was Thad Jones playing over the top of the band.
Hmm.
And you couldn't hear the band when you're outside, but you could hear him. You could hear him, this trumpet. I mean, no microphone, just blowing over the top of it. It was amazing.
Wow.
You'd get that, you get cranked up, you think that thing would melt down, you know. We think of it as more of an intimate, very harmonically odd and sort of inspirational improviser, you know,
mm-hmm.
very kind of, you know, kind of a heady kind of a thing, but when it came to just blowing straight out, man, wow!
But
stand back.
How much of that? The way that you described his playing came out of his being a composer. Do you think composer or arranger?
Oh, the way he wrote. I, you know, something that's an interesting thing. I've often wondered about that because his compositions that he wrote for Count Basie, the ones that got played anyway, you can compare them with other things. There's an album called Chairman of the Board or something like that. He's Count Basie sitting there, and they got all the guys sitting at a table around him, you know, and you can hear the things done by Frank Foster and some of the other guys in the band, and then you hear Thad's stuff. He did a couple, and you listen to Thad's arrangements, and they're very different from the others.
Mm-hmm.
They swing and all that. They say they got the Basie kind of thing, but they just got just a different kind of stuff in them. And I was always wondering if he just the improvising, he probably tried to do like the arranging equivalent of how he improvised, or was it the other way around? He was trying to think more compositionally as he improvised, because he sure did think compositionally, that's for sure. And what became the Thad Jones Mel Lewis band, a lot of that book was stuff that he'd written for Count Basie that the Count Basie said was just wrong for the band. It was too modern, you know.
Mm.
It was not the way that they could play, you know,
mm-hmm.
that he wanted the band to play. The band could have played it, but he didn't, it wasn't his style, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think Thad had written he basically wrote that book for Count Basie, and he rejected all of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's another player I want to ask you about who is also, you know, thinks compositionally, and I know that you probably admire, and that's Art Farmer.
Oh, yeah, very much, yeah. Art goes way back, you know. In later years, he just played flugelhorn and flumpet, you know, mm-hmm. that combination horn that does trumpet and flugelhorn. Yeah. Don't ask me to explain that. it's an aberration. Mm-hmm. You know, we're glad it's gone. Oh, anyway,
you think that was a sin against nature? Huh?
I do. They weren't meant to breed like that. My God, where is this country going? Everyone playing flumpets. He was a really great trumpet player. He never felt comfortable about his trumpet playing. Hmm. He always was working at it, you know, and practice and all that. But you could hear that he's really strong. You know, he took over Chet Baker's thing with. Did he take over after Chet, or was it after Bob Brookmeyer? No, I think it was after Chet Baker. Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker had this quartet, see, mm-hmm. and it was he got all this notoriety, and Mulligan went to prison. See, so that'll break up the band. That'll do it right there every time. Yeah.
Every time.
Anyway, and in the meantime, Chet started being a movie star and all that. Mm-hmm. And so when Mulligan got out of prison, he didn't have a trumpet player, and I think. When he finally put the band back together, it was with Art. Mm. And that was, of course, a very different band. And you hear some of the live stuff at Newport, I think, and the records they did. Art is really a very different improviser. He's kind of a lot like Thad, believe it or not. Mm. I mean, some of the stuff he does is, I mean, it's not as weird as Thad. Not as otherworldly as some of the stuff Thad would play, but he's got his own thing. It's very different, his own personality. Mm-hmm. All these guys, you know, if you know, you learn their playing, it doesn't take very long to get on to their sound because they sound a certain way. It's just an identifiable sound. And right away, I mean, you play like three or four bars of a solo, you know, that's Art, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't miss. No, he had an identical twin brother named Addison. Did you know that?
I had heard that, yeah.
And Addison was played bass, and his identical twin. Mm-hmm. And Art never got over it. Addison was killed in a car wreck or something, and Art never got over it. He never did. And you talk to him years later, it still bothered him. And I asked him one time, I said, man, was there ever any trouble in telling you guys apart, you know, when you were kids? He said, no. I'd get up in the morning, I'd walk over and pick up the bass, and if I couldn't play it, I knew I was Art.
if I couldn't play it.
You know, he said that the best learning situation he was ever in was playing with that Lionel Hampton's band with Clifford Brown in the trumpet section. Mm. I don't know if that band ever recorded, but they went to Europe and Clifford recorded a bunch of stuff over there. Lionel Hampton forbade the band to um, anybody in there to record while he was over there. He's paying the bill. He doesn't want them recording for anybody else. Mm-hmm. So they just stuck around and did it anyway, and we're glad they did. And but I remember I asked Art about that, and he said, man, I learned so much. It was like going to graduate school, you know. And he said, and the pressure was on you. I mean, he'd play a solo, and then you were going to solo on the next tune. You better get it going. You're going to just feel like a chump, you know.
Mm.
So he said that really, it was really a high pressure thing for him, and it improved his playing a lot. And so I learned a lot of. He said he learned a lot about harmony talking to Clifford on the band bus and whatever. They just talk about it all the time. Another guy in that trumpet section was actually Quincy Jones, you know. And I don't think he was a particularly good trumpet player. I think he was there because he was writing for the band mostly. And I asked Art. Art never said anything bad about anybody, I don't think, that I ever heard. And I said, what kind of a player was Quincy Jones? And he said, well, you could tell he had ideas. You know, as a jazz musician and trumpet player, that's kind of just about the faintest praise you can get, you know.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
Speaking of Clifford Brown, do you know this book, The Boise Lowry Method for Jazz Improvisation, the guy who was Clifford's first teacher?
No, I don't. I never heard of it even.
This guy, great trumpet player in Denver, Hugh Reagan, gave me a copy of it. I'll make a copy for you.
Man,
it's kind of interesting.
It.
I'd like to hear what you would have to say about it.
Wow. Is this a book that was printed back in the 40s or the 50s?
Yeah. It goes back a ways. And it's a lot of, like, leading tone exercises and chord studies. And
well, that'd be interesting. I'd love to see that. That'd be interesting to trace what if that was an influence at all. It certainly taught him some stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, when I first got to New York, one of the guys I made friends with was a trumpet player by the name of Bill Hardman, and I really liked him a lot. Somehow we became pals. He was a little bit older than me by about 85 years, anyway, he had been Clifford's roommate. And so we're talking about that, and he said, "Man, he had this." He had this violin book that he practiced out of all the time. Because, you know, real simple things on violin are just impossible for us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. And I said, what was it? He said, I can't remember. I remember it had a K in it or a Z or something.
Oh.
I went and I found it. And sure enough, there's a Kreutzer book, you know. You know
right.
that one?
Yeah, I got that book back when I was working with you. Actually.
Yeah, I went through. I said, "Do you remember any of these?" And when I showed it to Bill, he said, "Like, oh yeah, that's the one." At that time, they still had the same cover, even. And so we went through. Yeah, I used to play this all the time, but he'd transpose it, you know, play in different keys and do this one, Man, that was an interesting thing, you know. That kind of, I tried practicing out of that, and then I had to go lay down.
Well, tell me about Bill Hardman, because he was an influence on me because I loved that record of the Jazz Messengers with Thelonious Monk that he's on with Johnny Griffin.
He was a guy, he was kind of a meat and potatoes guy harmonically, you know. He knew what he was doing, but...
Killing.
He didn't stray too far from the fold, you know, that way. But he could put together a musical solo. It sounded, it always sounded good.
Yeah.
And he was like a very professional guy. I mean, he'd be there and he'd do the job and he'd sound good and he wouldn't mess anything up. And he was, I think he deserved maybe more recognition than he got. But around town here, he worked all the time. He was playing with Art Blakey. He was the trumpet player with Art Blakey when I first got to town.
Mm.
And I got to know him, and I just met him one time. I went up to see Art Blakey at that time, it was 1972 or 3. I was, I'm born in Northern California. I'd never actually seen Art Blakey before. Had all the albums, and I figured Art Blakey was about 6'7", 400 pounds, I mean, the way he played and the way he looked in, pictures of album covers and stuff. And here's this very small, short little guy, comes out and plays. Of course, he's short, but he's packed in there, he's just like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very powerful, strong guy. And so that was a shock. So I was just hanging out and talking with a trumpet player, and that was Bill, and so we got to be friends that way. And one time I was up there and Bill wanted to make time with this woman that was there. And it was time to go back on the stand. And so he goes over to Art and he says, "Hey, why will Johnny play?" And said, "Can he play? I heard him say that." He said, yeah, he can play. He said, okay. So we get up there, and he used for a test for everybody. You'll hear the same story from just about everybody. The first time they play with Art Blakey, he calls "Along Came Betty." So we get on the stand, and I'm thinking, "Oh, this is great. I'm playing with the jazz master as well." And so Art looks at me and says, "You got the first solo." I said, "Okay, cool." And so we play it. And so comes time, I start to play, and Art stops playing. Piano player stops playing. It's just me and the bass player. That's it.
Wow.
And a challenge, And fortunately for me, I got angry.
Huh.
I said, and I have this inner dialogue going there. Challenge me. How fucking dare you? You want to hear something? Okay, I'll show you something. Okay, yeah, how about this? What do you think about this? I'm actually having a fight, inside, and I'm playing, but at least I didn't fold because I wasn't afraid,
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Okay, you want to hear me play? Okay, how about this?" And so I played and played and played for like an hour, and finally I hear him say off to my left, he said, "All right, yeah, okay, okay, play your horn." And so then he comes in and starts playing. And we play a couple more choruses, and I'm starting to get tired, so I'm winding up my solo. And he does one of those single-stroke rolls that he did,
mm-hmm.
sort of like mm-hmm. throwing something down the stairs, You're standing on the same stage with it. It's like a freight train going by. It's a noisy. And he says, "One more!" Because he could hear me winding up.
Wow.
And so I said, "Oh my God." So I played another chorus and wound it up, and it was fine. Everything was good.
Nice.
And I walked off to the side of the stage, and I noticed that I was shaking. My mm-hmm. entire body was shaking, my legs, my hands and everything. And it wasn't that I was I realized I'm not afraid. I'm not angry. I'm not emotional about it. I feel happy that it happened. But it was the energy from him
mm-hmm.
it just was like a electrical current going through. It was amazing.
Mm, that's a great story.
Never felt anything like that.
Thank you.
So there's another trumpet player that you probably knew when you first came to New York, and that's Kenny Dorham.
No, he had passed by then. Oh. I was sorry that I didn't get to. He's I missed him by a little bit. Mm-hmm. But everybody that knew him, I don't know anybody that didn't like Kenny that talked about it. And I think in his last years, he decided he was going to go to college, and he went to NYU or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think he went to NYU, and
but he was teaching a lot too, wasn't he?
I think he liked to teach.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah. And he certainly knew a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, you ever think about the records of that he's done? The tunes that he writes, you know, he has these whole arrangements, endings and introductions and stuff, and all mm-hmm. kinds of, they're not just a tune that you blow on, and there's stuff to do. And he doesn't get enough credit, I think, because look at where he spanned. He was played with Charlie Parker, and he was playing with Joe Henderson. See mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's a long ways, and his playing changed over the course of that time.
So you didn't get to know Kenny Dorham, but I know a trumpet player you did play with is Benny Bailey.
Oh, yeah, very.
You described him as a wind tunnel.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, it was Sam Jones had this small big band, I guess, or large small band or whatever it is, two trumpets and trombone. And this was right towards the end of his life, you know, just before he got cancer and then died. But he became this band leader with this large ensemble, and it was absolutely great. Sam wrote a lot of it, and he was a good writer, excellent. Mm. And anyway, I remember sitting there with Benny Bailey on one side of me and Slide Hampton on the other, thinking, I'm going to lose a lung. I'm going to blow one of my lungs out through my trumpet. I know I'm going to do that. It's just like, I tell you, Benny Bailey was a pretty good soloist, I guess, depending on the tune. But, man, what a lead player. Just like, wow. And he went to Europe, he played like he was part of that Kenny Clarke, Francie Boland big band over there, and mm-hmm. that they had that was sort of like became very famous in Europe and was around. And he was the lead player on that, I believe.
Oh, great!
Yeah. But everybody had a lot of respect for Benny Bailey, and he's not well known, I think, because he didn't make albums of his own and stuff like that. But a real nice guy too.
I want to ask you, I've always been curious about this. You know, I got to play with Horace Silver, and I know you did for a while. And, you know, Woody Shaw was my big inspiration at the time, and he had played with Horace. And then what Horace was really looking for at the time, as I learned, was the way Blue Mitchell played.
Yeah, that's right.
Very different.
Yeah, very sound, different. But
did you have that experience at all?
Yeah, I did. I did. He was always telling me to listen to Blue, you know, like that, more like that. And I'm just coming right out, say it, you know. And see, I was, I didn't do that when I was a kid. I played when I was 30 years old, you know. I already knew what I wanted to sound like. Mm. I had my personality not fully developed, I guess, but I already had a personality. I absorbed a lot of people, and I felt I knew who I was musically.
So what did you think of Blue, though? I mean, you probably knew Blue, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I could have been wrong about that. But anyway, I tried not to, you know, he's your boss. You try to do the right thing.
Right.
I tried to do an imitation of Blue for that. So it wasn't really myself playing. Once in a while, I could just be me. But, and it worked out okay.
But do you like, did you like the way Blue played? I mean, he's fantastic.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. And I really liked him. Yeah. He was very, very good guy. Sometimes, I tell you what, he was very, a very nice guy, and he was very dissatisfied with his own playing. And in moments of truth, you know, he said, "You know what I want? You know what I want?" I said, "No, what?" He said, "I want to play one MF solo." I say, "I don't want to cuss on your podcast. I want to play one MF solo, just one, that I can stand to listen to. You think that's too much? Is that too much to ask?" With more expletives in there. And no, that would be nice. I hope to do that myself someday.
Ask you about Woody Shaw a little bit, because I know you were around him and you probably heard him a lot. I mean, do you have any insight into how he developed all that stuff that he plays?
Well, let's see. You know, I don't know. He was always interested in harmony more than he was melodic playing. Not that he couldn't play a melody, he could, but
yeah.
Lots of the solos are not that melodic, as you know, that you would memorable melodies, but there's harmonic stuff in them that you can't hardly believe, you know. And so, I mean, that's sort of the way he thought. And he's, I don't know, he's a very singular guy. I tell you what, he didn't sound like anybody else. Mm-hmm. It irritated him so much. Everybody called him Freddie's son or Little Freddie or stuff like that, and that bothered him a lot. And it should have, because he didn't.
Yeah.
He didn't sound anything like that.
Right.
It's different as night and day. You know. He was very, very organized kind of guy. Hmm. Now, in his personal life, he was not so much, you know. But musically, he was a thinker. He thought a lot about what he did. And he worked some stuff out and then tried to change it up and try to do things with it. And just a very, and he would work things out slowly, you know, and his fingers were amazing. That's some of the best technique you ever heard. Mm. And he would do these scale patterns. He'd take a scale pattern and then move it around chromatically and just do it over and over and over as you're in practice and, you know, on the breaks and stuff like that.
John, it's been incredible talking to you about all these trumpet players, but we wanted to play something else from your record, Hush Point, and I was thinking New Bolero, maybe. Is that one of your tunes?
No, that's one of Jeremy's tunes.
Is that Jeremy's piece?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I wrote the first one you played, the Finally Done. Mm. But he wrote this, and it's one of these tunes that simple melody and simple changes, and it just works great. And it's one of those tunes you can really sing as you play it, you know. And Bill loved to play that. This is the most fun I've ever had with the band, you know.
You mean being on the podcast with us?
With you, yeah. With being on the podcast, the most fun.
You mean the record, Hush Point.
Yeah, and I was going to say the most fun I've ever had with my clothes on. Except, actually, you're calling me at home, and I don't have any clothes on. Oh, man. Do you know that?
Too much information, John.
This is an entirely naked podcast right now.
All right. We'll be sure to get photographs to post it.
Yeah. You have to use your imagination, man.
Okay. John, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, man.
That was inspiring. Hope to see you soon.
Yeah, baby. Talk to you.
Take care.
Bye.
Listening there to an incredible conversation, mostly between Dave Douglas and John McNeil, about a million different great trumpet players. And that last piece of music that you heard was a piece of John McNeil's written by Jeremy Udine, and it was entitled New Bolero. You are listening to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast.
And if you want information about any of the tracks that we played, you know, John mentioned most of the names of the trumpet players, but there's full information. Go to greenleafmusic.com, and we have the show page for this episode, the official Trumpet Nerd Out Geek Fest edition of the podcast. And go and check it out, and, you know, visit us at iTunes and send us an email, podcast@greenleafmusic.com. Hope you enjoyed this one, and I know I did.
Yeah, we'll see you soon.
Thank you.